Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I would like to welcome you to an evening of the Michigan Writers Series, our final evening of fall semester, but we will be back again a winter semester. Our guest tonight is Allison Swan. Allison Swan is the editor of Freshwater, Women Writing on the Great Lakes, her own brainchild. A 2007 Michigan notable book, Freshwater collects the creative nonfiction prose of contemporary women who know the Great Lakes well. Swan's own poems and prose have appeared in many publications, literary and environmental, including Freshwater and Peninsula, Essays and Memoirs from Michigan. Her poem, Porch Swing, published as a limited edition handmade book, is included in rare book collections throughout the United States, including the New York Public Library, the University of Michigan, and Michigan State University in special collections. Her newest work, a personal essay about exploring the Pawpaw River watershed with her 7-year-old daughter, will appear next year in a Nature Conservancy book celebrating Michigan nature. The book's title is Michigan, Our Land, Our Water, Our Heritage. Swan holds an MFA in poetry writing from the University of Michigan and for many years has made her living as a teacher of writing and literature. She's a fifth-generation Michiganian who lives in Saugatuck, Michigan. In 2002, she and her husband David Swan were co-winners of the Michigan Environmental Council's Petoskey Prize for their so far successful efforts to protect Saugatuck Dunes State Park from development. Please join me in welcoming Allison Swan.
I'm going to come around, I think. Is the mic working?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to read for about 45 minutes. I'd be more than happy to answer any of your questions about fresh water, about my writing in general, about my environmental activism, about my years as an MSU student from 1980 to 1985. But I really enjoy a chance to talk about writing with people, so don't hesitate to ask questions, and don't hesitate not to if you don't want to. I'm going to begin with a piece from an excerpt from my piece that's in Freshwater called The Kettle. And it's a piece that's been evolving, I realized this the other day, for a year, for 10 years. I just stumbled because I realized I completely ungraciously did not thank Peter and Michael, Peter Berg, Michael Rodriguez. Thank you for hosting me here. I really appreciate it. So the piece I'm going to read from has been evolved for 10 years before it was collected in Freshwater. And the evolution continued during the Freshwater project because I began working on the essay with Onyx Smith, who's one of the contributors to the collection, a personal hero of mine. She's one of my literary and environmental heroes, and in her 70s, and helped me with The Kettle yet still more. So, it's as good as it's ever going to be. This is about a solo road trip I took to the northern Upper Peninsula to break into an old family cabin, which had recently been sold out of the family. My plan was to break in and take souvenirs. I have no idea why I thought this would be okay. I'm reading towards the middle of the essay. I've already arrived at the Mackinac Bridge. The first part of the essay gives a lot of backstory. At the north end of the Mackinac Bridge, the southern reaches of the Upper Peninsula, the scenery turns rugged. Even now, it takes just a few minutes to leave the stretch of small old hotels, gift shops, smokefish shacks, shiny new chain restaurants, gas stations, convenience stores behind. Although I had another 200 miles or so to go before I reached our old camp on Lake Independence, I was up north, where as a teenager I believed I might one day make a living in the wilderness, and where I hardly thought at all of the boyfriends I caught but couldn't seem to hold. Instead of feeling lighter, I felt the weight of gathering fear. Surely the cabin had a caretaker now. Surely any number of people would note my passage through town. It was a quiet time of year, perhaps the quietest, and the town of Big Bay is literally not on the way to anything. My thoughts became pep talks that went something like this. Once I get there, I'm going to break in. And not only am I going to break in, I'm going to take anything I want. This, of course, would not include anything that wasn't in the cabin when my grandparents owned it. Nothing of any real value, actually, except perhaps the antique fireplace tools. I considered the pros and cons of leaving some money on the table, a note even. I rehearsed what I might say to anyone who caught me. This little cabin has been in my family for half a century. I have slept in every room. At this dining room table, I have learned how a woman might stand up to a man and that a lady can drink beer. At this fireplace, I have learned that oak burns hot and long and that a nearly extinguished fire makes for the best marshmallow roasting. In these woods, I learned paper birch, balsam fir, star flower, lady slipper. In that lake, northern pike, walleye pike, and to shuffle my feet around freshwater clams the size of my mother's hand. My Marquette mother met my Detroit father fishing right out there. Legally irrelevant as the arguments were, they steadied me. Mature second growth forest crowds the edges of Big Bay now, and when I finally rolled into town around dinner time, I was struck by how the views from the edge of town out to Lake Independence have changed since my childhood. What was once open meadow was now a tangle of small houses, driveways, trees, shrubs the owners have planted or let grow. That's where they milled the side panels for the first country squires, my parents would tell us as we rolled along Big Bay's main drag in our 1970 country squire sporting fake wood siding. They used to be made from real wood. I don't know what I pictured, but I do know that the thought of putting real wood on a car struck me as hopelessly old-fashioned. I hated our station wagon anyway and dreamed of the baby blue Grand Torino. Anybody remember those? Copy editor didn't. I'd buy myself one day. I'd look down the grassy hill at the crumbling brick lumber mill looming seven stories above the meadows on the Lake Independence shore. Modernized by the Ford Motor Company in 1943, it was superfluous to their operations and closed several years later. A modern ruin, it captivated me, as did the abandoned train depot where a few decades earlier Henry Ford had sat down in my great-grandfather's chair, propped his shiny leather shoes on the desk, and engaged the ambitious man in conversation. I climbed that smokestack as a girl, my mother would tell my younger brothers and me, leaving out the rest of the details we never thought to ask for. Our graceful, gracious mother was once a tomboy. This seemed impossible. In high school, probably, she tells me when I ask her about it now, adding that she remembers nothing at all about the climb, except that she's sure she wasn't alone. She is, I know now, terrified of heights, and even as kids who saw our parents as indomitable, we'd look with doubt at the iron ladder bolted the length of that 190-foot stack. Certainly one had a view of Lake Superior from the tower. Could we? Oh, I'm sure it's much too deteriorated by now, she'd say. I drove through town, past my great uncle's old store, the small white church where I'd sat next to my grandmother for many Saturday evening masses, and the tavern where my grandparents used to pop in for a nightcap once in a while, and then back out the Lake Superior side of town. I glanced down the turnoff for Squaw Beach, where the big lake is relatively quieted in one of its few natural bays, and where we had a bonfire each August. Later, I thought. Ditches of swamp marigolds, as my grandfather calls the brilliant yellow flowers the book's name, marsh marigolds, made me wish my purpose was more playful. Certain the neighbors wouldn't be there, they almost never were, even in summer, I pulled into their driveway, a dirt two-track nearly identical to ours, closing the space between me and my goal to 100 feet of birch, spruce, fir, and oak trees. Wild lily of the valley, clintonia lilies, and windswept late afternoon light. The roaring south wind swept all the downstate relatives into my mind, even as I tried to put them out of it. Most of them wouldn't approve of my errand, except for my husband David, of course, who would have driven straight up the driveway and knocked on the door. I'd like to think my brothers would have cheered me on, perhaps even my mom and dad. I've since learned that, yes, indeed, they would have cheered me on. I almost wished I'd brought some reinforcements. For better or worse, I was left to my own devices. I can be a bold person, especially in conversation, but when a time for risky action is at hand, I hold back. I sat in the front seat, breathing the stale air of the car and listening to the wind. Had decades really passed since I'd taken my Barbies on wilderness expeditions in those woods? Since I'd rushed out to the outhouse and back during nights so black, everything beyond the glow of the cabin's windows disappeared. Once upon a time, arrivals at our cottage went like this. I'd jump from the book-cluttered nest I made in the back seat, not quite out of reach of my noisy, restless brothers who tumbled out the back, board games, comic books sliding out with them. The trees would close over my head as I raced up the short slope to the Lake Independence Bluff. My sneakered feet would kick up moss and acorns, then thunk down the wooden staircase and out to the end of the dock. There I'd gulp the lake air and scan the distant shores. The scatter of cabins looked like toys. For signs of change that came so gradually, they were nearly invisible. I am going to read two more short pieces of creative nonfiction. One is an excerpt from the piece that will appear in the Nature Conservancy book, and the other is a brand new essay. Actually, it's a work in progress, and I always like to read a few new things at readings and just see how they feel. And then I'm going to switch to poetry, because I think you'll listen to poetry in a different way. So I'll read the prose first, then move into some poems. So the Nature Conservancy piece was just a wonderful thing to have fallen to my lap. John Knott is the editor, and he's a friend of mine. He's a professor at U of M. And he was asked to edit this collection and came to me and asked me if I would participate in the project right as I was kind of casting about for what next after the Freshwater book was more or less finished. And so it kind of gave me a way to, you know, I don't know if any of you have written, actually it wouldn't have to be a book, any large creative project, when it comes to an end, it's nice to have a little lifeline to hold on to, until you find what the next thing is going to be. So this is what I worked on. I went to the Pawpaw River watershed, and the Nature Conservancy gave me my own key to their locked gates, to their various projects along the Pawpaw River. And anyone can walk into those places. They just don't want people driving in, so they have locked gates. And I went there by myself. I went there with the Nature Conservancy biologist who gave me an orientation, and then I went also by myself. And so the three trips together led to this essay, which is called Along the Pawpaw. And I'm just going to read the last part of it, which is about the wood turtle sanctuary that we visited. We are all hot, tired, dirty, and happy when we pull into Gary and Julie's driveway just a few miles downstream from the prairie fen we've just visited. Sophie and Dave are eager to see the box turtles I've told them about. In Michigan, every baby box turtle is practically a miracle, and here there are scores. Gary and Julie bought this house some 20 years ago. Almost immediately, it became clear that they'd landed in something of a box turtle sanctuary, and they set about managing their acres accordingly. I'm happy to find Gary at his back door pulling on his boots. In their backyard, we get our first good look at the pawpaw itself. A clear running brook, really, still shallow, so near the headwaters. Sunlight filtered through the treetops, dappled the bottom, and sparkled the surface. Sophie charges ahead with Julie, who's showing her things. Meanwhile, Gary points out the differences between the two sides of the trail. Box turtles need water, the river, cover, the woods, and especially open sandy places if they are not only to survive, but reproduce. Gary and Julie have been cultivating openings, mostly through the selective girdling of undesirable trees, for years. Recently, they joined forces with the Nature Conservancy, which reintroduced fire here in 2004. The right side of the trail was burned recently, and evidence, as at the Lawton Prairie, is subtle. More grass, more mayapples, more hepatica, a woodland wildflower. All evidence of a looser forest canopy admitting more light. Julie and Sophie are pulling up sassafras seedlings. Julie shows Sophie that the roots smell like root beer, a favorite of Sophie's, and she collects a handful to take home and simmer. With no prompting, Sophie notes the acrid smell of old fire and spots the colony of American colombos, huge and prehistoric-looking plants, like oversized garden lilies with sprays of flower bracts emanating from the single thick stem, about that thick. Colombos produce stems, leaves, and flowers anew each year, reaching heights of up to 8 feet in a growing season that lasts only a few months. In Michigan, they're uncommon. Here, there are hundreds. We head off the trail and into a sandy opening. Almost immediately, we spot a box turtle foraging. He begins to retract his head, then seems to think better of it, and instead trains his orange eyes upon all five of us. His species have been roaming our planet, essentially unchanged, for 250 to 300 million years, and I wonder what he sees. Sophie squats down closer to look. She doesn't seem to need to touch. The shell, about 8 inches long and 3 inches high, is beautiful, a pattern of yellowish-green flecks and dots on brownish-green. Another turtle I saw here bore an oranger pattern that seemed to have been stroked onto the shell with a paintbrush. Gary tells us that after the age of 4 or 5, each turtle's shell is unique, like a fingerprint. Where does he go during the fire? Sophie asks. We light the fire so early in the spring, Gary tells her, that he is still underground, sleeping. And think about where the heat from a fire goes. It goes up. He probably doesn't even feel it. A few weeks later, I hear Sophie tell her grandpa about our day near the pawpaw. She makes no mention of the heat, the scratchy prairie grass, or the long drive. The turtles are what she remembers most. I like to imagine her leading her children into a new sandy clearing to meet a box turtle. Individuals have been known to live as long as 150 years. Sophie's children might meet the very same turtle she did as a child. The last piece of prose is another Sophie story, very different. It doesn't have a title yet. Something that I think is useful for you to know when you listen to this piece especially is that I'm a backpacker, a wilderness freak, really. Given my choice, I would just spend all of my free time away from the built environment. It's almost impossible to do anymore, especially in Michigan. But I had the realization somewhat recently, which embarrasses me, that despite the fact that that is true, almost all of my day-to-day experience of nature has been suburban and urban. And it's because I've always chosen to live near city centers, and that's for environmental reasons. I've never wanted to be part of populating the places where wildlife has lived for a long time. And this could be a middle-aged thing, but just lately I've been kind of thinking, but wait, this is it. This is my one life. What if I had lived, you know, on a mountain and I'd already have seen cougars? And so I don't know. Next time you hear from me, I may have completely abandoned my staying near the urban centers idea and have built a cabin somewhere. But that's something that I think interesting to know when you hear this piece. Sophie is 6 in this piece. Let's walk around a little before we get in the car, Sophie said as she headed off onto the brown sod. The hot, dry air smelled of exhaust. The sun rose to the top of my dark head, and acres of cars stretched to the entrances of strip mall stores. But this was not a moment to say no. And anyway, I knew she didn't want to explore the parking lot. No doubt there are such children. I thought of the reproduction farmhouse I've seen, situated so that its wide front porch has sweeping views of a busy stretch of Interstate 196. And a 6-car garage. But Sophie is not one to explore parking lots. The strip malls south of Ann Arbor actually do have green space. It is uninspired and alarmingly free of weeds, but it's green. It's also full of ponds, runoff basins really, bureaucratically speaking, retention basins. Sophie made a beeline for one as I went back to make sure our car was locked. We are going to wander around in shopping mall nature right now, I was thinking, marveling at my 6-year-old's resourcefulness. If she could not get me to wander through the array and sparkle of Pier 1, then she'd try dusty green and brown growing things. She knows me well. A beer bottle toss away, 4 lanes of traffic widened to 6 for a major intersection. I considered what we must look like to drivers slowing for the light. Dressed for unpacking, I was wearing jean shorts, a well-worn t-shirt, and hiking shoes. My short hair wasn't styled. I was grateful to be wearing sunglasses. We'd come from gymnastics. And Sophie still sported her black leotard, to which she'd added anklets striped in primary colors and light-up sneakers. The roar of traffic might have been nearby Whitewater if the landscape had been less flat and paved, and let's be candid, familiar. I lived for 6 months at the opposite corner of this very large block in the white apartments of Charles Baxter's poem by the same name. Now I was heading off to explore a weed-choked drainage ditch with my daughter just around the corner from the field, the long-since built-over field, where almost 13 years ago to the day, I'd picked Queen Anne's lace for a centerpiece. The bank down to the muddy puddle of water was almost vertical, mowed as far down as the mower dared go, which wasn't far. Sophie stepped toward the edge, and I called calmly, I hoped, "That's pretty steep. If you're going to go down, you'd better go on your bottom." She stood still instead, and when I joined her, she pointed out the stinging prickers of thistle leaves mowed close to the ground and pervasive on these banks where the weed killers must not reach. "Ouch, I'm glad you didn't sit down," I said, and squatted down next to her. We peered into the murky water. To Sophie, it looked inviting, though I can't recall exactly what she said. "You can see the bottom," she added. Sophie was still afraid of water over her head, and while the surface looked opaque to me, I didn't say so aloud. She ran around to the southern side, threw me the widest of smiles, and called, "Hi, Mom." "Hi, Sophie," I called back, squinting into the sun. Then, to give her a moment to feel free, I wandered over slowly. When I finally squatted down next to her again to examine the slope, I found more spiky thistle leaves and just as steep a grade. I pictured bulldozers excavating the box. A path that Sophie pointed out was probably a rut left by the heavy spring rain, thick now with a summer's worth of shoulder-height, drought-resistant weeds, the same ones I noticed Riley that would triumph in our garden if I let them. There would be no way to get to that water without getting scratched up, which for the moment anyway made it a wild place. I wondered, though not aloud, what wild critters hid there. The sunnier east, north, and west slopes and the soggy bottom were lush. Goldenrod, cattails, purple asters, loosestrife, and a host of other things I couldn't name. We circled east, where teasels, dead and dried to brown sculptures, were at an arm's reach. I started to grab a stem to pull the pretty seed head closer to our faces, but it was covered with thistle-like needles, and I let go. As often as I have admired teasel-filled meadows, I've never touched a teasel. I would never have explored this particular scrap of land either if Sophie hadn't suggested it. And indeed, such places are cultivated mostly as scenery, something seen. It's become a theme of life with Sophie. She shows me how to get over my habit of engaging ordinary places with my eyes only, and too often through the closed windows of cars. The edges of the places where we park our cars can be downright exotic, and our children provide us with excellent cover. I kind of wish we'd climb down to the bottom, and I just didn't want to get scratched up. Yeah, she's kind of careful that way. So I have written very little poems about my daughter, very few poems about my daughter, and I don't know why this is. Maybe they will come when the experience of her is less immediate. The creative nonfiction scene, it's just, I have loved working in creative nonfiction to tell the stories about living with Sophie, life with Sophie. And poems are something that, for me, I think are more reflective and retrospective, maybe. And I'm going to begin. All of my poems are short, by the way, and none of them are very narrative. So there's going to be a real shift here in the kind of work you're hearing. I also wanted to mention while I'm at MSU that I started here in 1980, and one of the first classes I took was an introduction to poetry with Diane Wachowski, and it blew my world wide open. I had written poetry since I was 9, and Diane was amazing. It was amazing to have Diane come into my life when she did, because she wasn't only a professor, she was also a poet. And to me, that was magical, that this was a person who wrote poems and they were published and she was alive. You know, up until that point, I don't know that anyone had ever showed me poems by living poets. That's where I was introduced to the work of Gary Snyder. Alice Fulton is another poet Diane introduced me to, and I went on to study with Alice Fulton at U of M. I went to U of M to study with Alice Fulton, so I'm very grateful to Diane. This first poem I read last time I was here, I'm quite sure, and I feel I must read it here because it was written here. It was one of the first poems I ever had published. It's very old, and it's called Unmailed Letter. This afternoon, landlocked in traffic, breathing, dry, white, exhaust, I remembered your body, your long fingers, the large blue of your voice and eyes, smoothing across me like a river running into the deep grooves of its curves. I want to tell you how I plunge my hands into you, lay them dripping over my face, and you rill into crevices, liquid and cool. That poem came to me in traffic on Harrison. I felt I should read this poem tonight because deer season is almost upon us, right? And this poem is for someone who I met at Michigan State. I just realized that wasn't part of why I'm reading it, but this is for John Grassi, who I met here. And it's called A True Story. He is standing shin-deep in snow. He has been walking for hours. It is 16 degrees Fahrenheit. The sky is empty. A half mile off, a herd of elk move on the land like liquid. He wants to be closer. He sits down in the snow. He is not cold. The elk move toward him. He stays still till he hears hooves and snorts, sees the steam of their breaths. Without standing, this landscape is treeless, and he is tall. He tucks the gun to his shoulder. Sighting requires skill. Pulling the trigger, conviction. The walk down to the elk's body can be measured in yards. It feels endless. The rifle hangs cooling from his shoulder, fingerless. The ears are larger than he imagined, furred, the black nose so nearly living, he flinches. The steel blade gives an edge to his arm, bloodied to the shoulder. He must field dress the carcass, or risk spoiled meat. As a boy, he fished the green rivers of Michigan. So much green, even the air hummed. Now his father lives on the city streets where his mother died of exposure. These dry hills release their own river of beating hearts. It takes hours to get the meat home to his family. Two round trips by snowmobile, then a long ride by pickup. This is another autumn poem. When I was in the MFA program at U of M, one of my favorite people in my class died in the middle of the night. Suddenly, unexpectedly, a healthy long-distance runner. He had a heart defect that he didn't know about. And his wife was pregnant with her first child. And this poem is for her. Mary Benjamin Webster, and she's now a teenager. Let the branch break. March, the trees are dead. I am not alone in fearing this. Last October, the leaves were brilliant, as if lit from within. My friend, almost a father, died in the arms of the woman who would bear their daughter into the same sturdy embrace. Let the branch break and fall. Snagged or not, it will crumble into the air or earth. So familiar, we say. Mundane. Here's why it's not. Sap will creep. Bark will surrender its cache. Life will plod. Life will prod the living. I feel like I need to tell people at the beginning of this poem to listen hard because it's confusing and it's meant to be a picture. So if you let go of looking for a story and just listen to the images, I think it will work better. Sometimes I fear this is a poem that should only be read. You know when you go to poetry readings and the poem ends and you think, oh, it has to be read off the page. I'm not sure if this might be one of those poems, but I'm going to give it a try. It's called Early Spring. Across sunrise, branches threw out billows of green sail. Everywhere the brown sketch overhung by the flap of canvas, billows of spring, forest, olive, all there. And I looked from the one hill in town, watched over usually by a murder of crows, here a mass of glossy black feathers, and there a loner, blocking a thick branch where a squirrel crouches, bobbing at the tip. Every distant ridge disappeared. The sidewalk washed as if with green water, pulsed lifelike against the salt-beaten edges of lawn. The whole world asleep, weeks of buds, red mostly and gold, and of motion so minuscule that sleep seemed like death and opening. Silver sky, not gray, slid among the solid bodies of birds, lifted a few feathers, and caught the snap of sail. Everything touching and being touched, it can happen this way. A whole neighborhood animated. Twigs and last year's leaves gather light, black crows most of all, each one pulling in rays, holding on. I feel a need to read something slightly light. I'm going to read this one. I spent a year reading unpublished journals and letters in the Bentley Library at the University of Michigan by women who lived in Michigan in the 1800s. And trying to decide which poem to read. I have this one. I'll read the one by that. This poem was inspired by Isa H. Parker Smith. This was in her girlhood diary. These words. It's my poem. Her words, kind of rearranged to make a poem, but there were her words, almost verbatim, almost all of them, phrases arranged. But her girlhood diary. This was parts of this were on pieces of paper, scraps stuck into the diary. And the diary itself, I don't know how I found this. It was in a big box, you know, one of those cardboard file boxes, all labeled all her father's papers, and all the tabs were chronologically his journals. There's no sign that there was a little girl's journal in there. And for some reason, I opened the folder that had Isa's diary in it, and it was a thrill for me. So these are Isa's words, and I think it's pretty amazing, given how young she was. The poem is called The Dark Leap, Still a Girl. I wonder if others who appear so sensible are as foolish as I. Mother sugared off this forenoon and sent me with maple sugar to the neighbors. Our road too muddy for the sleigh. I walked. I met a silly-looking man with his hands in his pockets and a sunburned face. He asked me question upon question, beginning easily enough. Does your father want to hire a man? But then, I suppose you are not married. I am 14, and it is the kind of weather that always makes me feel as if I should like to go and lie down in the sun. The new grass is so green and soft and young. No, sir, not I. I suppose you would if you got a chance to. I started off. Whosoever lives on that farm there, are they looking for a hired man? I kept going. Where does this road lead to? Oh, give me a horse to roam through the prairie grasses of the West, where there are no men or folks. Let me taste something of the world. I have got to deliver this sugar, sir. I think she lived near Kalamazoo. I think if I remember that, she lived out in the countryside near Kalamazoo. Has anyone read the book, The Late Great Lakes? It's an environmental history of the Great Lakes, published in the late 80s by William Ainsworth. I wouldn't begin there. If you want to read, if you want to learn about the Great Lakes, begin with one of Dave Dempsey's books, or maybe Jerry Dennis's Living Great Lakes. Ainsworth's book is packed with useful information, but it's very depressing. And when I finished it, I closed the book and just cried. And this is the poem that came out of my grief. After reading The Late Great Lakes, the dead gave their last blood to birds, cardinals, red-winged blackbirds, and the downy woodpecker, red-capped, persistent, extracting food from bark in small portions with every season. Whitetails browse fairways, medians, and kitchen gardens. More real estate parceled, so a golf course gets 9 new holes. The sun appearing to set is a gorgeous ruse. We look but don't see. Spring's caddis worms, gritty and countless, creep to the edge of the Great Lake, where fish rise from the bottom and feed. Caddis worms are, of course, the larvae of caddis, the flies that a lot of fly fisher people know about. But I was walking the beach at Saugatuck one April, and I noticed little clumps of bits of twigs and gravel moving toward the water near every few yards, literally hundreds of them. And I'd never seen them before, I'd never heard of them before, I had no idea what I was seeing, but you know, I examined one closely, and then I went home and looked in my natural history books. I can't remember where I found the information, but that's what it was. And I think that experience that I had is, to me, it's a really good example of how your life can be enriched by kind of slow contact with the natural world, unhurried contact with the natural world. Because I could have learned about caddis worms by reading about them, but it was so much more powerful of a thing to learn because I actually saw them. The next poem is a poem, I think this is a poem about home. It's obviously a poem about home, but I didn't really realize that at first when I wrote it. It's a newer poem, and it's called For M, Who Escaped to San Francisco. The water here never stops moving, and the sky is a different sky from moment to moment. The beach builds and disperses, disperses and builds all year. In the back dunes, a relative stillness holds me. You know this. You know all this well, as you know Big Red, a lighthouse I have never heard you call by name. For years, I was too far from home to be among the girls sunning on the pier as you motored past, on your way to deep water. Now, when I see your nose and cheeks on the faces of my neighbors, my pulse feels exotic. It is true that every cell in our being is wild, not wayward, but animal, pulsing toward reproduction and death, loosed from us eventually, carrying away, making room. When I look north now, Big Red is brilliant, unless haze or night or rain has blurred the skin of the earth, which is much of the time. Even when I dream you are an absence, a remembered gesture, a loss that changes shape but remains. Dear, the Golden Gate is massive, picturesque, and so often photographed, the mystery of its curves inhabits many landscapes, though none as surely as its own. I'm going to read two more poems, three more. The first two are brand new. The first one is called Contact. The deer have been here. I say this to our dog, who lifts both ears and smiles. I'm sweeping the front sidewalk where snow lies thin as new dust over last week's ice. Enough for footprints. Our little yard is hemmed in utterly by the human. I guess the deer have adopted birdseed and squirrel corn as their browse. It pleases me that our nights are dark and quiet enough that these wild creatures cruise our sidewalks and streets while we sleep, or make love, or comfort our children when they materialize at our bedsides after bad dreams, leaving tracks of their own. The second brand new poem is going to be published in an anthology that this Ann Arbor world whirlwind force of nature poet person named Chris Lord. You might want to, Chris Lord would be someone for you to know about. She's a poet herself, but she does all these things to get poets together and get poets' work out in the world, and one of them is publishing this anthology of poems by Ann Arbor poets, poets with an Ann Arbor connection. And it's coming out next month, actually, so it'll be out really soon. And the poem is called Grace. We're a small group, a friendly group. If you have suggestions for a better title for this poem, will you tell me after the reading? Because Grace is, and that's like naming a poem Love or Peace or Faith. I think it will be the working title for a while until I think of something else. But if you have an idea, please share it. It has been sub-zero for days, and our house is snug, sure, but still. The sky is blue, the snow is blue, too, and if there's green in those evergreens, I don't see it. Winter, 100 days long. Midwinter, mid-Michigan, who doesn't love a cardinal? Something red and quick and loud. How many Februaries have I listened for their song to begin again? The songbirds, who have sacrificed so very much more than I, float above the trees even today when the cold is too cold for school. The cedar hedge scatters sunlight, and I see palm fronds, fuchsia bougainvillea, that even the barest trees are the perches of birds. Their hollow bones make them lighter than air. Their tiny hearts keep us all from freezing. Someone has an idea?
Songbirds.
Well, no, it doesn't need to. I know what you mean. It doesn't sound poetic enough. Well, how poetic does Grace sound? Thank you for that. Okay, I'm going to close with a poem that is medium old. It's not that old. But it's something that I wrote really to myself, but I'd like to close this reading with it because I'd like for you to hear it as sort of my some ideas I have on how you might live or how we might live, how one might live in this world, this crazy world that we find ourselves in right now. You can take it metaphorically or literally, whichever works for you. It's called Proposal for a National Forest Service Brochure. Park and undress in the empty parking lot at a trailhead. Any mountain trail will do. Let the sun pour down your back. Turn and close your eyes. Watch it pour orange. Dress for the trail. Pack food, water, and leave your human noises in the car. Climb till your heart, lungs, and limbs braid into the rope that pulls you on. Trees anchor switchbacks, give them your hand a few times, and brush gently against rocks and shrubs. Disturb no rocks, and when you return to the car, because of course you must, be glad for the seeds which, having hitched rides, will drop healthy in your wake. questions? Yes.
How did you get to the point where you decided to submit your first poetry poem?
I think I submitted my first poem when I'd already been in a number of workshops with Diane Wachowski and had accumulated enough confidence in the poems I was submitting. She's a very tough critic, and it worked for me because it made me work really hard. But that was how I did. And I think, and when I've taught creative writing workshops, I've made it a point to tell a student when I think, okay, you should submit these poems. But if you're not in a workshop situation and you're writing poems, and then I think that the best way to decide is to be well-read. And if what you're writing is starting to strike you as something that stands up to the things you're reading in journals, then send it. And, you know, I've submitted poems that years later I've gone, oh, I can't believe I sent that to someone. But that's just part of the process, you know. And I've gotten lots of handwritten comments back from editors, you know, oh, we liked this about it, send more. And that's always a thrill when that happens. But I've got, you know, plenty of the just generic little quarter of a page, no, not sorry, not for us. It's just part of the process. And I think sending out poems that maybe weren't quite ready for prime time is part of the process. And then years later you go, oh, thank goodness they didn't accept it. Anything else? Go climb a mountain.
There are books for sale up here.
Oh, I did bring books if you would like to look at them.
Alice would be happy.